Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Tonight, we start a small gem of a novel that encompasses a whole gambit of things. It's a love story, a mystery, and an exploration of alternate worlds. Shadow of Ashland by Toronto author Terence Green falls into that gray area called speculative fiction, somewhere between science fiction and magic realism. It's also an evocative study of complex personal relations and a sensitive portrait of small-town Depression-era Kentucky. But we begin in Toronto in 1984. Here's Michael Hogan as the voice of Leo Nolan.
My mother died on March 14, 1984. It had been inevitable, as all such things are inevitable. And although it had not been unexpected, it nevertheless left me in shock. She had been hospitalized just before Christmas. Accelerating arterial sclerosis, recurring strokes, and crippling arthritis had rendered her virtually immobile. She was 74. I am 40. Soon I will be 41. But these are mere numbers. And what numbers measure, especially those linked to time, I have never understood. And now I understand them less. She died, they say, of heart failure. When I visited her in January, she was rambling. She upset me so much that I cried. There were three other beds in the hospital room, and now I realize that I can't recall anything about their occupants. I only recall how, that day, I got up and pulled the sliding curtains around the bed so that we could be alone, so that I could hold her hand. Her fingers were welded into the timeless claw of the aged. The skin of her hands stretched thinly across bony knuckles. Lesions and brittle remnants of skin cancers dotted her forearm. But her eyes. It was her eyes, glazed, darting, frightened, the blue diluted as with a watery thinner. Jack was here, she told me. I frowned. Jack? She nodded. The eyes darted. I stared at her. Jack was her brother. She hadn't seen him for about 50 years. Jack was here, I repeated. She nodded emphatically. The eyes never ceased their wild circumspection. Her hand gripped mine. I told him not to go. I nodded, understanding. But he went anyway. Another nod, a pause. I felt the frail bones of her hand, watched the frantic eyes jump about, saw my mother as I had never seen her. He gave me this. The hand that I was not holding fell open and a fresh red rose fell out. It was part of the delirium, I realized. She could have gotten it anywhere. He's coming back tomorrow. Her eyes darted. I returned the next day. The wildness had passed. In its stead, tubes suspended from a bottle by her bedside snaked into her arm. How are you today? I sat down and took her hand in mine. Okay. The word was soft and dry. Her eyes, I noted, were steadier. She was back from wherever she had been yesterday. I don't want to die, she said. Nobody wants to die, but, she added, I don't want to live like this either. I nodded, comforted by the clarity of her answer. She understood what was happening, saw no solution, expressed it simply. Who would you like to see? Is there anybody you'd like to see? Her eyes focused on me calmly. Oh, yes. Who? Jack, she said. My parents had moved to their home in North Toronto in 1929. At the time, so I've been told, there were fields all about and a creek within a half a block. That afternoon, on my way home from the hospital, I drove to the house where I'd grown up. It looked like a house that an old man lived in, alone. Peeling paint on the eaves, a pitted and corroded aluminum screen door, snow unshoveled in the driveway. I knew he was in there. He is always in there. Tell me about Jack. My father lit a cigarette, holding it in his right hand. He jammed his left hand in his belt, as was his habit. He is 80 years old now. I am astonished at his white hair, his groping movements, the thickness of his glasses. We don't know what happened to Jack, he said. He left in the 1930s. He inhaled on the cigarette deeply, then let it expel slowly. What'd your mother say? Nothing much. I asked her who she'd like to see. She said Jack, that's all. He nodded. Things are never settled, that's why. Things have to be settled or they never go away. I waited. What happened, I asked. Nobody ever told me. He paused. I'm not sure. He lit another cigarette. It was time, he knew, for confidences. There were only the two of them, you know. Just Margaret and Jack. Jack was 2 years younger, born in 1911. We all lived on Berkeley Street together. That's how I got to know your mother. We were neighbors. Their mother died when your mother was just a kid. As a result, your mother ended up playing mother to Jack. Margaret adored her father, but the old man, as I understand it, wasn't much help. He always had a big cigar, always boasted. The old man was incapable of raising two kids on his own. Half the time he was never home. They raised themselves. He switched topic suddenly. Do you remember the old man, your mother's father? No, nothing. He died when you were three. Died of a heart attack on a streetcar on Christmas Day, coming here to see us. And that was it. The smoke hung in tendrils between us. I listened without changing expression. I wanted to hear it all. It was time to hear it all. And it was time for him to tell it. Your mother married me when she was 20, when Jack was 18. They'd been living alone for a while at that point. The old man had remarried a girl half his age. The stepmother didn't want his kids, so he abandoned them for her. This was the 1920s. Family life was strong then. Nobody did those kind of things. At least, he amended, nobody I knew. I turned my head to look out the kitchen window. It was beginning to snow. She wants to see him.
Who?
The thin white eyebrows wrinkled. Jack. He had caught the thread again.
He left in the 32, I think. We never saw him again.
Where did he go? Why did he leave?
Well, there was nothing here for him. He was a young man, about 21. He had no use for the old man. He could see through him. When Margaret married me, he was alone. I think he felt she had abandoned him.
He looked at me.
Well, try to see it from Jack's point of view. His mother dies, his father's run off and married some young thing. His big sister marries a guy down the street. This is the dirty 30s. Nothing for him here.
I shifted in my chair, crossed my legs.
He left the country, left Canada. Went down to the States. Last we heard of him, he was in Detroit.
Why Detroit?
Detroit was turning out cars. There were jobs.
Did he write?
Once, that I remember.
Did anyone try to find him?
RCMP came to the door here in 1939 looking for him. Wanted to know where Jack Grady was. He hadn't answered his draft notice.
I waited.
They never found him.
When the phone rang that evening, it was my father.
I found something you might be interested in.
What is it?
The letter from Jack that I remembered. And a card from your mother to him that was returned unclaimed.
Well, how old are they?
Just a minute.
There was a pause. I could picture him pushing his glasses up onto his forehead and squinting at the paper in his hands. 1934, he said. You want him? The excitement I felt was all out of proportion to the news. There was no reason for it. Yes, I whispered. I'll keep him for you. I'll be right over. I couldn't wait. The envelopes were yellowed. The one from Jack was postmarked February 22, 1934, Detroit, Michigan. In the upper right-hand corner, it sported a purple 3-cent Washington stamp. The upper left read, Return in 5 days to Vermont Hotel, 138 West Columbia, Detroit, Michigan. It had been torn open at the end. It was addressed to my mother. The other envelope was postmarked Toronto, Ontario, April 29, 1934. It was addressed to Mr. Jack Rady, care of Vermont Hotel, etc. And across the bottom there was a Detroit postmark dated May 3rd and a stamped imprint that read, Return to writer, unclaimed. I pulled the letter from Jack to my mother from the torn end of the envelope. It consisted of 4 faded sheets of Vermont Hotel stationery, complete with stylized letterhead. The handwriting was quite legible and in pencil. It was dated February 22nd, 34. Dear Margaret, received your letter okay and sure was tickled pink to hear from you. I'm sorry to hear Ronnie has been sick and I hope he is real well and yelling his head off when you receive this. I must be going goof or something. I was starting to think you had deserted me and here I had sent you the wrong address. It's funny we didn't get your other letters or Valentine's. They must have been lost in the mail. Gee, Margaret, I like it real well here. If anything ever happened now that I had to go back, I think it would break my heart. No fooling. I am working in the picture business for the largest and best paying outfit in town, and I like it. Do you know that coming here has given me an entirely new slant on life? I seem more anxious to be somebody than I ever have in my whole existence. Things seem to be pretty fair here, and you can live cheaper and make more money than you can in Toronto. I bought myself a nice pair of shoes last Saturday and a couple of shirts, etc., and I hope to have a new suit in a week or so. I need one badly, because I really am going to make something out of myself. I mean it, Marg. This all may seem strange to you, me talking this way, but I have to tell someone how I feel, and you are the only person I feel I can tell without being laughed at for dreaming. Everything is going to be okay now, though. And pretty soon I will be able to send you and the children and Tommy something from the USA. I also make it a point to get to Mass on Sunday. Write me real soon. Lots of love. Jack. I put the letter down and looked across at my father, who had been quietly watching me. Where did you find them?
In the trunk, at the foot of the bed.
He said he worked in the picture business. Well, what did he mean?
Margaret told me that he was working as a sidewalk photographer down there. She'd heard this from a friend of his here.
Sidewalk photographer? I blinked.
You know, one of them guys who used to snap your picture and then come up to you and offer to sell you the prints when they were developed.
I continued to look uninformed.
No, he sighed. I guess you don't.
I think I've seen them in the movies. Old movies, I smiled.
He smiled back. Yeah, old ones.
It doesn't sound like much of a job.
It wasn't.
I thought he went to Detroit to work in the car industry.
He shrugged. I don't know what happened. Sometimes things don't happen the way you plan.
I opened the envelope that had been returned unclaimed. There were 2 birthday cards inside. Not birthday cards as we know them, but birthday cards of the era. 2 flat, unfolded cards about 10 centimeters square, with elaborate, embossed, colored drawings of a bird in a garden and a galleon on the high seas, respectively. The former read, Birthday greetings, dearest brother. The other, to the nicest uncle on his birthday. Each was signed by my mother, for herself and for the children. On the back of hers was a P.S. Why don't you write? And this was it, I asked. My father nodded. You never heard from him again?
He shook his head.
She's going to die, you know. The eyes behind the thick lenses weakened.
I know.
She wants to see him. He shrugged and looked away.
He's gone. He never came back.
Then he looked at me.
What can we do?
I stood up, walked to the kitchen window, stared out at the snow-covered parking lot. Beyond it, the traffic inched along Eglinton Avenue. My mother died. Time. It was devouring us all, burying us in stratified layers impervious to archaeological probes. The snow melted, leaving puddles of slush that glinted in the sunshine. Then the puddles dried up and blew away with the April breezes. I stood at my father's kitchen window gazing out. In my hand, a mug of instant coffee steamed casually, emitting small rays of warmth. Behind me, saying nothing, my father smoked a cigarette with his right hand. His left hand was jammed in his belt. It was the 8th of May when my father phoned.
I'd like you to come over.
Anything wrong?
No, nothing wrong.
There was a pause.
At least, I don't think so.
What is it?
A letter came today. For Margaret.
I waited.
It's from Jack.
Jack? My mind was numbed. He's alive?
I don't know.
You don't know? What do you mean you don't know? You're holding his letter, aren't you? My voice had become a whisper. It was incredible.
Leo, listen to me for a minute.
I could hear his breathing as he waited.
Will you listen?
I calmed myself. Yes.
It came in the mail today. It's postmarked Toledo, Ohio.
He's in Toledo? It was both exclamation and question.
The letter's 50 years old, Leo. It's postmarked April 30th, 1934. It's written in pencil, just like the other one. It was written and mailed 50 years ago. But it came in the mail today.
Michael Hogan, reading from Shadow of Ashland by Terence Green. Tomorrow, more letters arrive, and Leo embarks on a trip to Kentucky. Our poetry nightcap is also a missive from days gone by. It was penned by the 19th century British poet Christian Milne. She uses flattery and humor to request a favor in her poem, Sent with a Flower Pot Begging a Slip of Geranium. It's read by Donna Goodhand.
Sent with a Flower Pot Begging a Slip of Geranium. I've sent my empty pot again to beg another slip. The last you gave, I'm grieved to tell, December's frost did nip. I love fair Flora and her train, but nurse her children ill. I tend too little, or too much. They die from want of skill. I blush to trouble you again, who've served me oft before, but should this die, I'll break the pot and trouble you no more.
Christian Milne's poem, Sent with a Flower Pot Begging a Slip of Geranium, read by Donna Goodhand. It's from the anthology Women Romantic Poets, edited by Jennifer Breen and published by Everyman. And that's Between the Covers for this evening. If you'd like to contact the program, we can be reached by email at btc@vancouver.cbc.ca. Or you can send us a letter by post to P.O. Box 4600, Vancouver, B.C., V6B4A2. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, and then it's classical music from CBC Winnipeg on Northern Lights.